Everybody, welcome to the 50th episode of The Bog right here on DLive.tv/Dave Martell. Unfortunately, this could very well be our last episode here on DLive as we are migrating over to the Neurona Society YouTube channel, which you guys should go over and like, subscribe, share there, and like, subscribe, share over on my channel, which is Dave Martell, which you can find all of the previous episodes of The Bog. I've uploaded most of them into a playlist for everybody, so you can go check it out, watch all of the stuff, even including vintage episodes with me and my former co-host, the very intelligent, very awesome Angriff, where we go and talk about all kinds of awesome stuff in the early days of The Bog from The Bog Vault. But tonight we have a really awesome guest. We have all the way from Canada, Neil John, a professional Vedic astrologer, and he's going to talk to us about Vedic astrology and all kinds of stuff and how this pertains to Western astrology, because I don't know anything about Vedic astrology. A week ago when Tristan told me Mr. Neil was coming on, was like the first time I heard about it. I didn't even know they had astrology. I mean, I guess I assumed they did, but I don't know anything about it. So Neil's here to tell us all about it, because here on The Bog, we really love digging into the Indo-European roots of everything and digging into the Eastern philosophies, the Vedic traditions as well, which, by the way, on July 5th, we are going to have the Acharya himself on The Bog. It's going to be over there on the Neurona Society YouTube channel. But without further ado, Mr. Neil John, thank you so much for coming on The Bog.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Just to get started, I guess, the history of it, I think, is probably what we want to get into. So I actually, just talking to you the other day, Tristan, you brought up an interesting comment about how Jyotish, which is actually what Vedic astrology is properly called in India, Jyotish is actually not a totally native tradition to India, the way that, like, say, Western astrology is to the Hellenistic period of Greece. So, in fact, there is a contact between Greece and India via the Great Alexander, the Alexander the Great. So basically what happens is that there is a particular text. It basically just means it translates to, like, Greek nativity. The Yavana Jataka. And it's a text that was translated into Sanskrit roughly around 150 CE. And it didn't really make a cultural impact on astrologers in the region for probably another 50, 60, maybe even 100 years, depending on who you ask. And what basically happened is that prior to this Greek contact in India, Jyotish was a purely lunar system. So they actually were more concerned with the movements of the moon. They did not have a zodiac in the sense that we would conceive it, where there's like 12 signs and they are fixed, measured essentially by, like, determining, okay, where's the sun at the vernal equinox, which is how we do it in the West. They basically said Aries always is at 0 degrees, at the vernal equinox. There's other variations on that, but that's more or less what most of them we're doing is we're seeing where the sun is at that particular time of the year and saying this is the fixed zodiac. Every single year it's the same. In India, this is not the case. So what happened was they had a lunar system where they broke up essentially the same stars into 27 smaller pieces, sometimes 28. And in some very obscure sources, we can find evidence that there may have even been a system which actually was 18 signs. And it's not clear as to whether or not they were limiting the sky, they're only interested in a certain portion of the sky, or they actually had kind of taken the entire thing and divided it up in 18 pieces. So you'll see a lot of different variations. But when the Greeks came into contact with the Indian astrological tradition, what happened was is they took this 12-sign zodiac system and integrated it into theirs and took on some of these more solar aspects. So they started to pay more attention to the sun. A lot more attention was actually paid to the planets, period. Prior to that, there's actually not a whole lot of mention in early Vedic texts concerning astrology about planets. It's really more about just sort of obscure references to when certain events should be held, things should be done, when is something auspicious or inauspicious. So they were definitely watching the night sky, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that watching the stars specifically was the primary focus. But then this attention to the planets seems to start to develop, and they are called in India the grahas, or the navagrahas, which basically just means, nava means nine, graha means planet, or to grab, to hold, to pull, and which is actually quite salient when we get into
so roughly more. That which influences us.
Yes, and it's important it says pull. That does not mean determine, fix, or preordain. It pulls. It's a gravity, right? So this system essentially is born from a synchronicity, or a syncretism between the Greek system, which actually underwent a peculiar shift around the time that the Indian system was integrating it. So in India, we have a method of correction. So the actual heavens are shifting all the time. And basically every 72 years, the entire zodiac from our relative perspective shifts an entire degree westward. And so what's happening is that this is called the precession of the equinoxes. So when people talk about Age of Aquarius, for example, they're actually talking about when a full 30 degrees has been moved through. And the zodiac, I think it's something around roughly a little over 2,000 years, if I can remember correctly, like it's like 2,100 years and change. And basically it takes, that's how long it takes for the entire zodiac to deviate from the standard we're familiar with in the Western system, a full sign. Right now, it's deviated in the last 2,000 years, 23 degrees. So if you think you're a Cancer, you're actually probably a Gemini. It's just like that's the kind of like disparity we're talking about here. The Western system.
All right, so to use me, for example, I think using the Western system, I'm a Taurus, but really I should be like an Aries or something.
Yes. Yes. You could be, you still can be a Taurus in the sense that there is a 7-degree overlap where that can still happen. It's just the likelihood, like, I mean, most of the time you're just wrong. The whole thing is completely thrown off. But now people might say, well, what's the significance of that? Right? Like what are we really talking about here? If you look up in the night sky and you actually like, where is the actual physical planet in relation to the actual physical constellation that we're talking about in astrology, you will notice that Western is astronomically, not just astrologically, astronomically 23 degrees off. So they're not even talking about where things are at all. It is completely detached from the reality in the sky. There's no relationship anymore. 2,000 years ago, I shouldn't say that, roughly in 100 CE or BCE, I can't, we're talking about 2,100 years, roughly, years ago. The two systems were in alignment and since then have deviated. So the Greeks said, we're not going to continue to make corrections for the shift of the stars. And we're just going to say Aries is Aries, Capricorn's Capricorn, vice versa. Like, we're just not going to do this anymore. And they basically come up.
Basically, they just put it down on a calendar and they stop looking at the actual astronomy.
It was basically turned into a calendrical system. It's all of its esoteric import was then placed upon the seasons, the local customs, holidays, festivals, historical events. And it was a way to kind of say that we don't really care about what's going on up there anymore. And if we do, we only want to talk about it in purely metaphorical terms. Whereas in India, we have a system of correction called a Ayanamsha. And that actually is there's a couple different ones though, is the trouble. So there's some debate in India, which Ayanamsha is the correct one. It's a debate you can only really settle by practicing astrology. You just have to use the ayanamsha that you find, and you see if you can make accurate predictions or analyses with it. The most common one is Lahiri, which is actually relatively modern, but it's the most popular, and it's sort of a reconstruction of what they believe to have been the corrective method of the original Vedic texts. And that's basically what you're looking at. Now, the actual system of astrology that we see in India has an origin, of course, that predates this sort of Hellenistic contact. And that dates back to roughly the 14th century BCE. And I should say that there's a particular text, the Vedanga Yotisha, and that is the first major astrological text in the historical record in Sanskrit. And from there, the tradition develops. Now, obviously, that's simply when the text was formed. I imagine that they were looking at the stars and sort of trying to make predictions or sensitive things by observing the night sky long before that. I mean, you can look at any mythology in the world, and you're going to see some kind of attention paid to whatever is going on up in the heavens, the firmament. Like, we're always, as a species, really trying to figure out how what's up there relates to what's down here. So in India, the systematic approach to that seems to take form, in literary terms anyway, around 3,400 years ago. And it started out with, like I said, this lunar mansion system, where you have these very small portions of the zodiac being given particular attributes and associations, which has been added on to over time. So as the Vedic tradition complexifies, more disciplines are added, more specificity is given to different areas within Vedic esotericism, practice, and the sciences that it was sort of beginning to develop. So what you might call Eastern forms of alchemy, you have Ayurveda, for example, is very closely related to Jyotish. So a lot of medical advice is actually based on planetary associations. You know, certain medicines were believed to be more effective or less effective, for example, depending on where the moon was in any given time. We would use the chart classically, the natal chart, to determine what kind of diseases someone might have, what kind of afflictions or injuries they might be likely to have, conditions that they may be more impervious to, and or even to diagnose something that was difficult to diagnose. Let's say someone's particularly sick, the local doctor can't figure it out. They will go to a Jyotishi, an astrologer, and he will see what's in the chart. He'll look at, like, say, their sixth house, which largely deals with disease. He'll look at their Saturn placement, their Rahu and Ketu placement, and he'll try and figure out what's going on there. What is there? Is there anything that there is a gravity, a sort of, is there a strange attractor in the fate of this person's life, like in like the overarching sort of structure of their life that would cause them to suffer from something? So that's more or less how we kind of see Jyotish fit into the overarching Vedic tradition. It's one of many disciplines that was used to augment and kind of flesh out the central praxis of the religion. Which actually brings me to another point. I kind of already mentioned it, Rahu and Ketu. So in the West, there is a sort of vague understanding of this concept in the astrological community, but it's not really something that a lay person would be aware of at all. So in the West, they're called the northern and southern nodes of the moon. And what they actually are is they're not even real physically planets. They're just these points in the orbit of the moon, the ecliptic of the moon, that represent the portions of the moon's orbit which will inevitably cause solar or lunar eclipses. And there are two points, and these two points are 180 degrees apart at all times. In India, they're represented as Rahu and Ketu. They're the two halves of this demonic entity that was beheaded by Vishnu in a myth wherein this demon Svarbhanu tries to steal this nectar. And he's disguised. And just as he gets this first drop on his tongue, Vishnu beheads him. But it's already too late. He's already achieved immortality. And now he exists as this head and a body. And they are often referred to as the head and tail of the dragon, of this great serpent. There's a lot of different symbols that you'll see. But generally speaking, we're talking about something that is like a demonic, insatiable head and a demonic, endlessly satiated and detached body that is without ego. So you have these two kind of conflicting but complementary forces, and they're present in everyone's chart, and they represent these sort of karmic forces in our lives. Now, in the West, there's not very much of importance placed upon them, but in the East, they are greatly feared. And even to this day, if you talk about Saturn, or I should say in India, it would be called Shani, or Rahu or Ketu, it's in a hushed voice. They are intensely feared planets. They're associated with terrorist attacks, earthquakes, tragedies, floods, madness, anything to do also, especially with Rahu, where as far as Rahu and Ketu are concerned, anything to do with outcasts, people who are outside of society, that could be criminals, it could be radical or highly unorthodox sadhus, like the Aghori, for example. And they represent chaos, darkness in our lives.
And when you were running my Shodasha here, was that part of what came up to say that when you were interpreting it as saying that I was removed from society? I must have some sort of positive tie to that.
No, well, yes and no. You have a nakshatra which is classified as Mleka, outcast. So when we talk about how all the nakshatras have associations, they each have a deific. So there's a particular Vedic deity or god form that is associated with them. They have a caste. They have a sort of a typology wherein they could be either Manusha, human, godly, which would be Deva, demonic, Rakshasa. They are all assigned a guna, so they'll be Sattva, Rajas, or Tamas. They're all assigned various elements. They're all given a Ayurvedic constitution, which is essentially like a body type. It's a gross, vulgar description, but we really can't get into Ayurveda tonight. That's just a whole other subject. But
it works for the simplification.
Yeah, but every sign has a lot of associations, much more than you'll find in the Western system. So although they do use the 12 zodiac signs, they are almost run parallel in concern. Most Jyotishi are looking directly at the nakshatras, which is what we call the lunar mansions. So these 27 smaller signs. And when I say that, say you have within your chart the prominent nakshatra, so let's say it's where the moon or the sun or the ascendant is, which are formative for the personality. If one of those is of a particular caste, we will see that manifest in the person's life. So if someone's Mleka, then they are, after some fashion, an outcast. They could be Shudra, Kshatriya, Vaishya. You could see Brahmin. There's also more particular specifications. So you'll see farmer come up, or butcher. There's a few of them have a butcher caste. So it can get pretty specific. But generally speaking, it gets into one of those typologies.
Real quick. Sorry about that.
Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, real quick, I wanted to give a shout out to a couple donations. We got a donation from Good Texture, sent us a lemon. And also, Light of Decay, our homeboy, the best graphics creator in the world, sent us a Ninjini. Big money right here, these guys. Many thanks to both of you, and many blessings to both of you. I have a real quick question, Tristan, before you guys continue here. Mr. Neil, you mentioned something about in astrology there is kind of like a dark look or a negative outlook towards, you mentioned the Aghori, like the left-hand path, the practitioners of chaos or chaos itself.
Well, here's the thing. We have to remember when we talk about dark, there's a very different connotation in the Eastern tradition when we talk about dark, because dark does not necessarily mean evil or wicked. It could have a very different connotation. So, for example, if we talk about Rahu and Ketu, which are widely seen as demonic, there's a lot of superstition around them, but yet we know that they are very important in our chart. We all have this. It's not something that's unique to certain people. They're representative of certain strata of society, but it's not so much a moral judgment as it is a classification. So the Aghori, for example, that's essentially a very extreme tantric left-hand path tradition within Shaivism. So these are people who are operating completely outside the norms of society, right? And so Rahu, which does not abide by the laws of the gods, but apparently in a lot of the mythology, is actually subject to a higher order. So it sort of operates outside of the norm, but it serves a function. There's actually a lot of versions of the myth wherein the demons Farbanu, from whom Rahu and Ketu are created, is actually known to Vishnu. When he beheads him, he knows that he's going to try and steal the nectar of the gods. He is aware before this even happens, allows him to do it so that he can create Rahu and Ketu because they serve some kind of karmic purpose. They are kind of like these divine punishments or trials. And what we're meant to do when we say we do a nativity for a person, and we're trying to figure out, you know, what's messing them up, like what particular area of their life is giving them trouble. We're going to look at Rahu and Ketu. So Ketu will tell us things they're detached from, things which pertain to past lives, karmas, ancestors, things which they've inherited genetically, perhaps. It will tell us about parts of their life that are hidden from them in their subconscious. And using that information, we can help them actually realize that Ketu is trying to teach them something. Like they need to, this is an area that requires attention. And it's the same thing with Rahu. Rahu deals with obsessions, delusion, innovation, progress. It's a planet. I do not mean like a physical body. Like we said before, this is not a physical thing. It's a shadow planet. It's like a, but, or in India would be called a chaya. But Rahu is essentially this shadow thing that tells us these are things that we are obsessed with, where these are an area of our life where we have very poor self-control. We're likely to overindulge in or have gross misrepresentations of in our mind. They have a lot of psychological import, Rahu and Ketu. And the reason why they're feared is because they're grossly misunderstood. People have this notion that something bad is happening to them, that they don't deserve it, that it's got nothing to do with them. But in the Vedic mindset, we have this notion of karma. So your life is just a small piece of a much larger story that you've been a part of since before you were born. You have accrued in that time all kinds of cause and effect, which have produced the nativity. That's what's happening, is we're actually, when we look up at the sky, we are seeing a map of that that tells us anyone who's born at this particular moment, this is why. This particular message writ large up here is going to tell us what this particular person's karmic inheritance is. Why are they the way that they are? That's the theory of astrology, is that we are inheriting something and we are born at this particular time because that is when all of these things align to reflect that. There's sort of an as above, so below kind of a thing going on here.
So, and then I have one more quick question because we got to go to halftime and show Focus. Focus Farmer's got a video for us, and we're going to go to halftime. But the reason I asked that was because you mentioned the Aghori. And now I'm not an expert on Sanatana Dharma, but I've spoken with people that do practice. We've had Kerwin on the show. I have friends that are over in India. I've spoken with people. And the consensus is when you brought up Aghori, I was like, Aghori are in this? Because, you know, the overwhelming view of left-hand path and of the Aghori is mostly negative. And, you know, over in India, they throw rocks at these people. You know, I mean, they're not fans of these people. So it was kind of interesting to me that these aspects were also found in there because, in heathenry, we also have people that claim to be left-hand path, and it's kind of like, you know, this and that. And me and, you know, Tristan, those of us that are Setish and those of us that are, you know, of proper tradition, we look at this left-hand path as something that is negative, and I believe rightly so. So how is it that the Aghori and kind of this stuff gets tied into astrology without, like, triggering people, without them being feeling this negative thing? And how does it get into all of this? What role do these people play?
So they don't have a direct connection to the tradition in the sense that astrology has something to say about everything, is really the way it has to be seen.
Okay.
So when we look at, say, the nine planets, so in this system, we don't use Uranus, we don't use Pluto, we don't use Neptune. Some people do, but generally in traditional Vedic astrology, we don't bother with the outer planets. Some people will contend that it's because they were not known to the original Vedic astronomers. And others will say that they were, but they were not seen to be a personal significance to our lives, and that they had a more civilizational or generational impact, and thus were excluded from the canon. I don't really care. All I can tell you is that, practically speaking, the nine Navagrahas are what we're looking at, right? And they all lord over a portion of reality. So regardless of the moral content of, say, left-hand practitioners, right, and whatever tradition that is or whatever they mean by that, because there's obviously a lot of variety and diversity even within that camp. But when we look at that world, we know that it falls under these particular planets. So we know that Saturn, Rahu, and Ketu, after a fashion, have a rulership over these kinds of traditions, these kinds of people who fall into that part of reality after some fashion. So when we look at, say, the Aghori, right, we're not talking about Jyotish has a moral value judgment. Hinduism does, Indian culture does, like we do, but the planets themselves, they manifest every possibility. There is nothing that.
So it's a universal principle, it's like a universal system. It's like, you know, something you would say, like, between us and then, say, like, you know, a Satanist or like some other, you know, goofy person.
Yeah.
Gravity applies to everybody. Doesn't matter if you're a good person,
yes,
or a bad person, or a crazy,
yes,
person or whatever. It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah. And this is the thing that I have discovered in my research. So I chart a lot of films, for example, because I personally believe that there's a great deal of modern comparative mythology that can be done. So we look at a film and we say, we will always have debates, like, what did the movie mean, right? Like, we look at Apocalypse Now, we try to pick it apart. What's the mythopoetic character of this film? It is my claim that if we chart the actors and director in a film, we will notice that there are patterns. A lot of them will share signs or a planetary dominant. It can get very specific, and we'll notice that the symbolic content of a given sign that is prominent in a film and in the charts of people who make that film and act within it are actually extant in the film. So this kind of contribute, you know, this is sort of an extension of that conversation. So we talk about like Agori for, you know, fall under this sort of planetary influence. I'd be willing to bet if we charted a lot of Agori people, we would find out that most of these people are born under the auspice of these kinds of planets. They play a large part what forms their personality, what makes them the way that they are. I mean, you can find all kinds of very unsavory, despicable people that consistently have a particular planetary signature that you'll see in their charts. And so, you know, a nakshatra, a particular sign, like a moon placement, it can have a very high functioning, respectable, noble incarnation, or it can produce a very ugly, horrible, almost inverted version of it. So a really good example would be like the nakshatra Hast. Hast is a portion of Virgo. It literally means Sanskrit for hand, and its deity is Savitur. So it's a very solar nakshatra, but its actual planetary rulership is the moon. And if you look at how it presents in people and in film, it's mostly thieves, people who deceive others for personal material gain. Even though classically speaking, Hoth is actually mostly associated with rulers, nobility. So, you know what I mean? Like there's this lower functioning sort of almost Kali Yuga manifestation of it that's very, very common. And you see this with all of them. And unfortunately, most of the manifestations of the nakshatras we see today are actually quite negative, low functioning and ignorant. So these are people who are not aware of themselves, who are immersed in what you would call Maya or illusion. So you'll see a lot of this, like especially if you study film. Like this has been my obsession, because as soon as I started doing it, like the amount of like synchronicities that you'll find, mind blowing. Like my favorite one, maybe we can get into it after the break, because it is a bit of a mouthful, just how prominent Saturn nakshatras are in people who play the Joker, for example. Almost every single one has a moon as a moon placement in a nakshatra ruled by Saturn. Every single one. It's nuts.
That's incredible. And then we have a question from the chat that I want to hit after the break, and I'll let you chew on it while we have our break. Our break's going to be about 5-6 minutes. So our homegirl, Miss Volkfire, wants to know, she says, probably an unpopular opinion, but I don't see the planets as anything more than rocky planets. So she only sees them as pieces of rock in the sky.
Right, and she says, I'm not sure how they could be anything more.
So let's get right into that.
I understand why people would.
Right. Right.
So let's switch over to the break.
Well, we got to go to a Focus Farmer first, who's going to cook us some nice stuff.
Let's see what he's got to say, and then we'll get right back to Mr. Neil John and all of this really fascinating Vedic astrology stuff. See you guys in a couple minutes.
Good morning, guys, and welcome to the Focus Farmer. Today's a little bit of an unusual day. We're definitely not in the kitchen, and what's unusual about today is it's about 45 degrees outside this morning, and this is in June, so this is just what we get in the mountains sometimes. It's going to be 80 later today, so it's been quite nice working out this morning and, you know, tending to the fields and stuff like that with cool weather, which brought me to something today that I really wanted to talk about, which is a scythe. A lot of people have a lot of misconceptions about a scythe, what a scythe was actually used for, how it was used. And of course, we have the modern myths and stuff surrounding the Grim Reaper. You know, a lot of times whenever you would see this, this is going to be something you see around Halloween time or something. But to our ancestors, this was a super important tool. This is how you would actually have made hay back in the day. You would also have cut your grains like flax, oak, barley, so on, with a scythe. And a scythe is a really easy tool to use, but it's a really hard tool to master. So I just wanted to go over a little bit about the scythe, talk a little bit about it, and why it was so important to our ancient ancestors. So we'll kind of start off with its design. It's a very unusual design. It takes a little bit of practice getting used to swinging the scythe and getting into a rhythm. And when our ancestors would cut a field, there would be several people working the scythes, and they would work them in angles and rows so that the hay that they cut would fall over. That would then be allowed to dry. Then they would come back up, bale it basically, or twine it, or put it into wagons and throw it into the barn. So there was a lot of different storage techniques, and that's something that I'm really going to focus in on, especially with the Nirona Society's Academy. I'm going to be doing a lot of in-depth studies and a lot of in-depth different techniques that our ancestors would have used, and then compare it to our modern techniques. So I have a tractor, I have a bush hog, a baler, cutter, and all that fun stuff. But I do find that when I cut grains, it's much easier to actually cut the grains that I grow, especially flax, with a scythe. It's also easier to clean out ditches and stuff. And I'm going to talk a little bit about this first blade here. This is what we call a ditch blade. And notice it's a very short blade. It's a very wide-angled blade. And this is not the majestic kind of use that you would think of for the scythe. This was literally used to clean out ditch lines. I have it on to, you know, essentially clean out some nastier parts that I can't really get a tractor into, or a weed eater is not effective when the grass is yay high. So these things are actually very useful on the farm. And I did want to show you the difference between the blades. So this is, like I said, a ditch blade, and this is a mowing blade. These are both from Austria. There's very few places in the world that make these anymore, unfortunately. But this is a really nice blade too. You can see how much longer the hay cutting or the mowing blade is versus the ditch blade. So it's a lot of work. And like I said, with the Academy, one of the things that I'm going to do is kind of show how these tools were actually used. And if you notice on the side here, I actually have a sharpening stone. This would have water in it, and you would come through every so often and just kind of go ahead and give it a couple of courtesy swipes there to resharpen the blade, because this is one thing that's unlike your mowing deck. If your mower, your blades aren't all that sharp or whatever, you'll still beat the grass down. With this, if your blade is not sharp, you're not cutting squat. So it was super important to have very sharp blades. As a matter of fact, our ancestors would actually have one person in the field that his job was literally just to sharpen the blades. So you would come, you would give him the scythe, he would sharpen it real quick, you'd take a water break basically, and then jump back in the field. So it was a lot of work. And like I said, with the Academy, when I have more time, probably 15-20 minute segments, I'm going to go through and show you guys how to actually cut the hay, how to make the hay and everything with this. And then we're going to compare it back to, you know, our modern farm equipment. So I also wanted to say congratulations to Dave on the 50th Bog podcast. What a wonderful podcast it has been. So I look forward to 50 more from you. So congratulations, Dave. And I'll see you guys over at the Academy very soon. And we'll be going over a lot of different farming techniques. So if anyone has any questions on scythes, there's been a great book that's put out. His name was Peter Tresman. He wrote a book, and it's a very comprehensive book looking at medieval Europe and even some of the Amish techniques that are used today for hay cutting and various techniques, which is fixing things like this where I actually hit a rock. So it's basically taking a hammer and putting it in and beating this thing back in and then resharpening. So it goes over a lot of that stuff. So if you guys are interested, I highly encourage you to check out that book on scythes. And like I said, check me out over at the Nirona Society Academy, where I'll be showing a lot of these different techniques, how our ancestors did it. On the final note, just think of the workload. In modern times today, when I was growing up, we had about 30 head of cattle, and we would need essentially 3 cuts to be able to feed our cattle, and that was off of about 10 acres. In medieval Iceland, it took up to 50 acres of grass to be able to feed their livestock with no modern equipment. So think of that as to how much work was involved with the scythe. So it's no coincidence to me that the scythe is associated with the Grim Reaper, because when it was time to go out into the fields and work the fields, you were probably half dead when you come back. So check me out over at the Nerona Society at the Academy, and I'll be doing a much more in-depth study on the scythes. I'll be showing a lot of the techniques and stuff. And once again, Dave, congratulations on the podcast. Look forward to seeing you guys soon.
All right, we are back. Sorry about that, folks. I had a little bit of technical difficulty, and we are back. So let's get right into the question there that we had, which was, what about folks that think that the planets are just pieces of rock floating around in space?
The easy answer to that question is that they are just rocks floating around in space. Everything is just something in space. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, this notion that we have that the material world is only selectively divine is ultimately erroneous. Like, so we'll say, oh, this was a miracle, but this is a mundane regular occurrence, right? This other thing, this is special, that's not. Either it's all ultimately derivative of something transcendental, spiritual, or none of it is. The planets are being paid attention to not because the physical body itself is sending some kind of energy that we don't know about, or it's not doing something physically. It is more like a metaphor. It's like an actual metaphor expressed through a physical thing.
So it represents a metaphysical, like, yeah, Platonic ideal.
Yeah. So what we'll do is we'll say, I'm over here, the planet's over here. There is, and we're on the same plane of existence, the material world. There is a thing above us, actually many things, many, many tiers of things above us that have action which exerts itself upon this world, right? These things are both reacting to it. So we have a singular message, right? A particular form is reifying or becoming manifest, and it affects both me and the planet. The planet is moving in accordance with the exact same sort of timeline, continuity, whatever, as I am. And the theory is that everything is in some kind of synchronicity. So Jyotish is just one kind of divination. Like, some people claim that they can determine the nature of the future or a given thing by observing the movements of birds. You know what I mean? Like, you can see people doing things like number sticks. There's all kinds of things.
So, like, in the Germanic tradition, we would cast the runes in order to provide divinatory responses.
Yeah, and it's exactly the same idea. We're just looking at a different thing to get this information. The reason why Jyotish is so detailed is because there are so many factors to pay attention to, and there's such a large body of mythological information ascribed to all these different bodies and stars and movements and combinations of positions, movement, everything. So what we're looking at here is something that has a lot of potential descriptive language that we can apply to a given divination. Now, that can still be dismissed. You can still just say that's a very nice, maybe it's not, maybe it is, I don't know, maybe you disagree, that's not a tidy explanation, maybe it doesn't make sense to you. But what if you can find out, like, what if there was a way to test it? Now, in the West, astrology has been thoroughly debunked by science. They've gone over it a million times, doesn't work. They don't seem to be able to do anything with it. If they are, it barely registers as above statistical averages or noise.
Right, like cold reading.
Yeah. And, you know, I accept that, because if astrology has any real meaning, I think that you should at least know where the planets physically are. And as we discussed in the first half of the episode, Western system has no understanding of the night sky. They're not telling you where anything is in relation to anything else in any way that's meaningful. It's completely
right. They're telling us very meaningful things 2,100 years ago.
Yeah. It doesn't apply anymore. So Jyotish does, theoretically. So we have to test that. The best way to do it is you have to look at something that everybody can go out and do themselves. Like, there's a website, actually, I recommend anyone who wants to do this, with just shit ton of data on it. It's called Astro Data Bank. It is a Western astrological site that logs the birth times and birth information, I should say, of various celebrities and historical figures. And it's the largest database of astrological data you can find online. And they have rating systems for the accuracy of birth time, but whether or not a birth certificate was used to ascertain the time, everything. And so you have a massive database that you can subject to various surveys. And if you do that, you will find not only patterns, but ones that are well above the order of statistically significant. So, for example, if you take the 250 boxing champions that are logged in that site, you can put all of their charts through an Ayanamsha correction calculator, and you will get some pretty interesting results. For example, I actually did this survey, and the result was that I think it's something like, out of 27 possible signs that a person could have for a given placement, boxers, Mars placement was over 20% of the time in a particular nakshatra in Aries called Bharani. Now, 20% doesn't sound like a lot, but if you think about the fact that we're talking about something that should only happen 1/27th of the time if it was random.
And right, it very quickly becomes statistically implausible.
So we're talking about 1/5 of the time, not 1/27th. That cannot be ignored. You know what I mean? And this is a tiny example. Like, and we could come up with theories like, why is that? Well, we can analyze it. Another thing you can do is you can take film, and film is where this stuff really comes alive, and it blows my mind every single day. Like I can't tell you the amount of things that I've found. I'm actually working on publishing some of this stuff online just to kind of start disseminating it. But one of the things I took interest in was the cinematic history of the Joker. So basically, if you want to find out where that character came from, it actually starts with the film. Well, I shouldn't say that. Where it starts in film, modern media, because it goes way back further than that. We can talk about the Harlequin, the Saturnalia, all kinds of fun stuff sometime maybe, but we just start with the film The Man Who Laughs, 1928. The star is a man called Conrad Veidt. He has a birth certificate online. You can look it up. He is Uttara Bhadrapada Moon. So that is a Saturn-ruled nakshatra. It's a portion of Pisces. Now, Bob Kane, the creator of Batman, he goes and sees this film. And it actually stars a character. It's literally a man who has been given a permanent smile. He was a slave, and then he's marked with this horrific grin that he can't get rid of. And it's this kind of Germanic expressionist film that kind of just details his tragic life. But Bob Kane just thought that the face was so horrifying and strange. It needed more of a life. So he wanted to kind of, he basically stole it. And he put it in his Batman comics, his Detective Comics. And then, years later, we actually have someone else play this character for the first time. And that is Cesar Romero. He is Uttara Bhadrapada Moon. So that's two now. Then you have a series of voice actors do him on television. We have a man who's Anuradha Moon. There's another Uttara Bhadrapada Moon native, a Pushin native. All three of those are Saturn nakshatra. And by the way, there's only three of them. There's only three of each planet. It has three nakshatras. So you're looking at this one particular planetary influence showing up for just the moon over and over and over and over. Then we have Jack Nicholson. He's the next major cinematic role for the character. His ascendant is Pusha. So Pusha shows up again. Then Mark Hamill, who basically is probably one of the most famous people to play the character, is Pusha Moon. Then we have a couple of smaller roles in some animated films. We have Brent Spiner, who's probably more famous for being in Star Trek. He's Uttara Bhadrapadamoon. He voices the Joker in a television show. You have a whole litany of just smaller parts, and you'll see Saturn pop up there.
About Jared Leto, like the worst Joker.
Leto,
he's not.
He's
in
not.
There, right? Yeah, because he's the worst one.
And as we all know, he was never the Joker.
He was never the Joker.
It's he's never no. And that's basically that's my verdict. My verdict as an astrologer is like not legit. No good.
he was then, so bad the cosmos rejected him.
Yeah. Now Heath Ledger. Ostensibly broke the pattern, but then I looked into his birth information, and there's actually a 3-hour window in which he was born, where Uttara Bhadrapada could very easily be the ascendant. So it's entirely possible that this is maintained with him, and I would say that that's likely given his how beloved the performance was, and the fact that every other major actor to play the character who was in any way respected for doing it. Was Saturn. It was a Saturn man. Joaquin Phoenix, Uttara Bhadrapadamoon, again.
Wow.
It's extremely...
And also an excellent portrayal.
Yes. Now, I actually have the hard data. Out of the 27 people I found who have done anything, I mean even voice work in like a Lego Batman video game, like anything, 16 of the 27 people, so 16 have a Saturn placement. That is so insanely above the statistical average.
Yeah, that's what, 60% when it should be 1 out of 27?
Yeah, it should be incredibly low, but it's not only is it not, but it's super prevalent, and it even may have a very interesting symbolic relationship with the character. So we could go all the way back to the Saturnalia, and we see all these traditions pop up. We're talking about people who are slaves and working class people, like, you know, free Romans, but essentially laborers. There's a festival wherein the Saturnalia, wherein these people are given free reign to the city. There's actually a Saturnalikius. Oh, how is that? What is that term? Saturnalikius. Rex, I believe that's, I'm probably have totally messed that one up. But anyway, there's a person who's chosen as the Lord in a given region of the Saturnalia, and he's almost always a slave or a working class person, like a lower class.
Someone who is low in society.
Yeah.
Because one of the main features of Saturnalia was a reversal of social functions.
Yes, yes. And so he would be given this role as the Lord of Misrule, which is actually what the later Christian tradition would end up doing with this practice. And lo and behold, what is he given? He would wear a strange mask. He would wear a cap called the Pileus, which is essentially the antecedent to the fool's cap, which is obviously, part of the clown wardrobe. And then they would wear rich, colorful clothing, and then would essentially turn the whole world on its head. And this was meant to appease Saturn, to kind of let the whole lower class stratum blow off steam. It was kind of like a way of thanking them without upsetting the order of society permanently. It was just kind of like a way to kind of let off some steam, allow this sort of Saturnian class, lower class rage to kind of burn off and then settle back down. So what is the Joker? If we look at Joaquin Phoenix's portrayal, for example, he's actually that's what he is. He's a lower class individual, inspires a rebellion.
Almost an exact one-to-one parallel for that, just transposed to the modern day.
Yeah, it's exactly the same thing. And the character always serves the same function that Saturn does in mythology. He is challenging the hero to become something more than what he currently is. He serves as this very necessary component, this adversary that forces you to grow up, to become more, to take responsibility. We see this pattern come up again and again and again in the Batman mythology. Batman won't take his rightful aristocratic right to kill this man and fix everything. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In astrology, when you have a Saturn return, when Saturn returns to the position that you were that it was in when you were born, you are challenged. It's around when you're 27, between 27 and 30. It's a very hard time for people. That's actually why a lot of celebrities die around the age of 27. That's 27 Club. That's what that is. It's Saturn return not going well. And what it means is the person is not growing up, not taking responsibility, giving in devices, not allowing discipline into their lives. They're reaping a karmic consequence. And this is what Saturn is here to do. Saturn's not actually an evil thing on the cosmic scale. I mean, in media, the Joker could definitely be said to be an evil character, obviously. But on the cosmic
scale... Actually, if you look at it in the last movie, he's even portrayed as the protagonist.
Well, he is.
And in the Roman tradition, Saturn was considered a very benevolent god who ruled in the age before the actual gods.
This is very true.
And before we get into this, I got to read some donations real quick, guys. So, for my boy, Heavy Metal Brother, Full Moon Ancestry donated one Ningini. He says, ancestral faith matters. Hail to you, my brother. Of course it does. He donates another one. He says he donates a diamond. Says, stay safe, stay secure. Our lives matter. Thank you very much, brother. Thank you for the kind words. Thank you for the kind donation. And then we have a diamond from our boy, The Light of Decay. Hail to you guys. Many thanks. Many blessings to everybody giving the kind donations tonight. Thank you so much for our 50th. The Bog turns 50 tonight. That's quite the accomplishment. So back to, then we got it coming in. Folkish Farmer donates a Ningini. Thank you very much, Folkish Farmer. Much love to you, brother.
Yeah, so basically what we're looking at here, though, is we're seeing a recapitulation of mythology and actually lived tradition in film completely without any knowledge of the people making the film. They could be complete atheists, entirely enmeshed in modernity, and they will still live out some kind of variation of this story. In fact, the enemy in the story, the Joker film, like the villain, is a Jupiter man. Robert De Niro is Purvabhadrapada Moon. He's Jupiter down it. And the antipathy between Jupiter and Saturn, I'm sure, is not news to anybody. Only in this version of the story, it's Saturn that ends up killing Jupiter, or I should say dethroning him, as opposed to the other way around. So we see every permutation, possible permutation of the interaction of these archetypes constantly being pushed into the world in film, in our lives. And that's really the overarching thing. That's what astrology is here to do. It's not here to tell you, hey, like, you're fucked and nothing you can do about it. This is just how it's going to be. It's like the more that you can learn about what are you an expression of? What are the things that prefigure you? The more you can work towards actually kind of playing your hand. You know what I mean? Like I'm born into the world. I don't really get to choose what I'm stuck with, but I do get to make some decisions about what I'm going to do with it. And the more I know about what I'm dealing with, where my weak areas are, where my strengths are, what kind of pitfalls I'm going to be looking at ahead, the more I'm going to be able to kind of actually overcome the gravity, the graha, if you will, of my fate,
so,
and make something better.
So, because you do this professionally. So, how would somebody want to find you, and what is like, what is the process of going about hiring you to do something like this?
Currently, I have a pretty standard package. Like, what I like to do is I kind of don't bother with the traditional astrologer model where they kind of have a copy and paste. Like they'll basically look at your chart and they'll say, okay, I'll just take the generic explanation for A, B, C, and D, and I'll just put it all in a file together, and I'll send it to them, and we'll do a 1-hour consultation over the phone. And that way they'll be dependent on me in the future, because that's not nearly enough information to do anything with. It's usually, if they're any good, a parlor trick where they can prove that they know something about you that they shouldn't, unless astrology was real or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Like I might see someone who has like Shravana moon or something, and I'd be like, oh, this guy probably has a terrible relationship with his mother. Which is, by the way, an insanely common thing with that sign. I'm actually blown away by how often that happens. Like alcoholic, neglectful mothers and stuff like that with Shravana moon people is just astronomical. I see it every single day. It's nuts. But you'll see that. That's kind of fun to find out that, like, oh, that works or whatever. But what do you do with it? So what I like to do is I say, I'm going to write up a 17-page, it usually ends up being with 17 to 18 pages essay, which explicates every single part of your chart, what's going on. I'll try and find mythological excerpts that relate to the various symbols that relate to your signs and how they're going to play out in your life, what you should do about what you've got, spiritual practices, forms of meditation, various like things that you should maybe consider with your career, any facet of life that I can help you out with. That's what I'm going to try and include in the essay. And I send that to you along with a visual representation of your chart in the North Indian style. It's just the easiest for me to understand visually. And I think a lot of people find it more intuitive. And that's basically $90 US. I think it's, depending on the conversion rate, like it's about $90 US. It's like 120 Canadian. And it's a lot of material. It's a lot of material. The other thing I'll do, if you don't feel like breaking the bank, that's like a big deal. I will do like a $50 US consultation just over Messenger. Not really like a time limit on it or anything. It's like maybe like an hour or 2 hours sometimes. And I'll like prep for like, I don't know, a couple hours beforehand just to make sure that I got a good handle on what's going on in there. And maybe I have to look something up if it's something particularly unique. And then we'll get into it. And I tend to have ongoing contact, with clients. So I don't charge every single time I talk to somebody. It's really only for initial consultations, and I'll keep in some kind of contact if they have follow-up problems or anything like that.
And where can folks...
And you can contact...
Go ahead, yeah.
I was going to say, you can contact me on Facebook, just Harry Neil John McRae.
Can I post your Facebook into the chat here?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right.
I also have a page I'm just started working on Facebook called Iron Age Jyotish. Jyotish is spelled Jyotish. That's basically going to be an outlet for a lot of my research, but I might transition into using that also as a point of contact for clients. So that's where I do that kind of work. Right now, there's a tiny bit of a waiting list. It does take me a couple of days to pump out some of these essays. If you're in more of a rush, or if you have a really specific thing you want me to deal with, you can just go right for the phone call consultation over Messenger chat, whatever you're comfortable with. And maybe we can only focus on a particular thing. We can do a general reading, whatever you want to do. Yeah, that's basically how I would approach that from a I approach things from a business standpoint. I'm not really I do it for a living, but it's not like this thing where I'm particularly greedy about it. Like, I'm really more concerned with just trying to do something with it to help people. I feel like a lot of us would like to have some answers about things that are going on in our lives. I found this really just kind of hit me. I actually met my girlfriend introduced me to it. And I was incredibly skeptical of astrology. Western astrology was just a gross disappointment to me. I never identified with my sign or anything. I thought it was kind of silly. It was like some kind of, you know, yoga pants, white girl thing to do. Never bothered with it. And then she just told me some stuff about these signs, and I was like, well, that's something that really appeals to me. Like, I kind of, that sounds like me. And, you know, I started reading this marvelous book, which I recommend to everybody. I'm going to do a plug here for Prash Trivedi, The 27 Celestial Portals. This is probably the best book on the Vedic system. Just the nakshatras. Doesn't really get into how to do anything with it, really. But if you want to know about the mythology and the symbolism behind the signs, it is a phenomenal text. I highly recommend reading it, even just in the PDF form if you have to. It's a phenomenal book, and it'll just give you this introduction to that world. And you may find you actually really identify with these signs. But like the big thing to realize too is that there's so many different versions of variations in how this might manifest in a person. Like, you take a couple Saturn people, put them next to each other, you might not see any immediate similarities. But let's say we get a large number of them, you'll notice there are particular types that show up over and over again. Certain facial features, like the physiognomy of this, or say the physiognomy of this, is actually insane. Like, I've gotten pretty good at calling out a lot of the types. Some of them are a little harder to pick out. Like someone who's Venus dominant and they're a man, they're probably going to be kind of ugly, to be perfectly honest. They have buggy eyes. Features tend to have a very strange, lumpy, kind of exaggerated look to them. Like, Steve Buscemi is an excellent example of a Venus man. Willem Dafoe, Quentin Tarantino.
And I am very glad I seem to have missed that one.
Yeah, you could have very easily had a Barani face. That would have been a bad time. And then you see, like, the stereotypical Saturn man actually looks a lot like Nazi propaganda versions of, like, what a Germanic face is supposed to look like. A very exaggerated chin and cheek bone structure, jaw structure. Super exaggerated. Like, they tend to look like...
Dolph Lundgren.
Yes, Dolph Lundgren's a Saturn man. So is Woody Harrelson. Who else do we have? David Bowie. Actually, Lesnar. So is... that's a good question. I should look that up.
I think you said Arnold Schwarzenegger, yeah, too, as well.
Schwarzenegger is... I don't know if it's his dominant. It's tricky. He's also K2, so he might... And they kind of look similar. They both tend to have exaggerated features. I think he looks more Saturn. I know some other astrologers who differ on that, so there's a certain look that they'll have. Very large, built up face, like lots of like kind of pouchy like structures around the mouth. Very Germanic look, even if they don't have German ancestry a lot of the time. Large, cartoonish kind of depiction of what a man is supposed to look like, almost. Versus the very underwhelming Mars. Mars men do not look like that. You'd think that Mars would be hyper-masculine looking, but it's actually kind of more muted, subtle. Edward Norton, Eminem, Buddy who plays Jesse Pinkman or whatever in Breaking Bad, that's a Mars man. Like, the easiest one to spot is actually Rahu or K2. Huge eyes, pale, and generally have like an unsettling quality to them. People kind of find them either off-putting or there's just something kind of empty about them, especially a K2 person. There's like a void in their eyes. And there's different genres of music. We see concentrations of a given planetary dominant. There's artistic movements. There's it's insane. Like, you look at a political movement, you could like chart everyone in a particular political party. You will see something pop up. If you chart, for example, all the SS members, for example, that are on Astro Data Bank, you'll find out there's a lot of Sun, Venus, and Saturn kicking around in there. Especially Saturn. If you chart communists, you'll find a lot of Venus and Saturn actually as well. Saturn just generally likes politics is actually the thing I found. You'll see.
So wait, aren't the Venus guys ugly?
Yeah.
So you're saying all the communists were ugly?
Apparently, yeah. Karl Marx is double Barani. He's Barani Moon and Sun. He was definitely not a good looking man. So you'll see a lot of that stuff. It's like I said, like the patterns are very consistent. It's a super easy thing to prove. Like it's honestly amazing to me. It's like this best kept secret. If you want to like completely destroy someone's materialism, you can just show them it's a handful of examples and give them all the information that they need to go and get the exact same results that you did. Here's a Jyotish calculator. Here's the birth certificate information. Have at her, come back when you find out that like I was right. Like that's basically what it comes down to. Like it's a system that's consistent and effective. I haven't had a single client come back to me and say, oh man, like you've completely missed the mark. None of that happened to me. I'm not like this, whatever. No.
So you could just pretty much just talk to somebody and like kind of make a guess of what they are, right?
Yeah, I do it all the time.
Well, what do you think about Big Dave? Where am I at?
I have to get a good look at your face. You're redheaded too. Would you say you have a temper?
Big time.
You're probably Martian, dude.
Martian? Hell yeah.
You're probably a Mars man. I wouldn't be surprised. Or Sun. Sometimes Sun and Mars are kind of difficult to pick apart from one another. Would you say you hold a grudge, or you're kind of like angry and you're super pissed and it just goes right away? And you don't even.
It goes right away. I'll forget like after I'm as soon as the anger's gone, I forget about it. Unless you do some scumbag shit to me, and then I'll hate your guts forever. You know what I mean? But if it's like you piss me off, I'll apologize like an hour later, because usually I'm terrible.
When I see somebody who's got your coloration, I'd have to take a good look at your face to really like be confident. But I wouldn't be surprised if you were a Sun man. Sun men are actually pretty fascinating characters. They're very dominant. Have like a regal kind of a quality to them. People listen to them, respect them. They're kind of the real Chads, if you want to go with the meme.
That's
lingo.
Definitely me then.
I love to hear that. What's actually interesting is that what I find funny is that the Chad meme depicts someone who looks very Saturnian. Men, when they kind of overvalue or exaggerate masculine ideals, they tend to produce Saturnian things. But when it's a more organic, natural charisma and confidence, it's solar. And
so as we were talking about a couple of days ago, Giga Chad is actually a good example of a Saturnian.
Yeah, 100%. That's exactly what that look is. That's like a Dolph Lundgren face. That's a Saturnian person. There's actually something vaguely homoerotic about it, if you ask me, because there's something, there's this hyper, like if you survey women, what kind of faces do they like? They find the hyper-masculine face of, say, someone like Dolph Lundgren to be kind of a put-off. It's only really men that like that. Men are into it. They idolize it. But that's actually not something women are interested in. If you look at the what is actually just so happens to be, if you follow astrological physiognomy, the typical solar face is actually what women are interested in.
Ha-ha! Dolph Lundgren wrecked. It's Big Dave's on deck.
Yeah. Which was it? What did you say my face was? Was it Jupiterian?
You have a more of a Jupiter face. So it's got there's a sort of... See, your Jupiter placement's tricky too, because you have Purva Bhadrapada. So Purva Bhadrapada is the stormiest, most intense Jupiter sign. It's a very hyper-dualistic thing too. It's kind of either very nice... or very not.
For all the viewers, being the hyper most extremist part of the sign is basically my entire astrology.
Yeah. Basically, all three of your signs are quite intense. It's the best, probably the kindest way to put it. I shouldn't say kindest. It's not like if I was being brutally honest, there'd be anything terrible. Purva Bhadrapada is a very intense sign. It's actually hard to find people who present it in a way that is not very dysfunctional. They kind of are people who think that they are the arbiters of right and wrong. Because Jupiter is the judge, the lawmaker. And if he's low functioning, he overestimates his position. And so instead of deriving his authority from the sun and making judgments in accordance to that, he actually makes judgments in accordance to his own will and becomes self-serving. So, and arbitrary. Now, the epitome of that is so poetically portrayed in the film The Dark Knight. You see Aaron Eckhart, who is Purva Bhadrapada's son, play Two-Face. And that is exactly what he is. He's a completely arbitrary, blind notion of justice. There's no, the right and wrong are just outcomes of his justice, that they have no deeper meaning. That is Purva Bhadrapada in the modern world, unfortunately, a lot of the time. There's a lot of low functioning Purva Bhadrapada people out there. I don't think that Tristan is an example of that, but it's unfortunately common.
I'm sure people who know me can see signs of it.
Yeah. Now, interestingly enough, if you look at some of these 3,400-year-old texts on these signs, Purva Bhadrapada is given the symbol of a two-faced man. So we're actually talking about this two-face archetype existing for a very long time associated with this sign. And then a couple of people in the West made a film where this character was portrayed by a man who has this sign. So you just see this stuff constantly. It's actually pretty intense. Like, I'm actually in the middle of a project right now where I'm taking every single biographical film I can find, which is a bigger number than you'd think, and I am just comparing the chart of the actor to the historical figure. And so far, I have a statistically significant number of cases where they share a sign in a prominent placement, so the sun, moon, or ascendant.
All right, Mr. Neal. Unfortunately, yeah, we are pretty far over time, so we're going to have to shut it down here. But we'll do a part two, and we'll bring you back in for some more stuff. I'm distributing the chest, sure, so everybody gets the lemons. One more question in the chat. Our homegirl, Miss Michelle, says, so he can tell me this based on my birthday or no, or only a selfie? He told me before the stream he can judge this by feet pics. So send feet. I'm just kidding. Don't send feet. That's so creepy. But anyway, so, Mr. Neal, we got your stuff in the chat. Folks can go check you out. Iron Age. What's it say? Say it again. Iron Age what?
Jyotish.
Very, very cool. Yeah. So thank you so much for coming on, Mr. Neal. This has been an excellent episode. Please stick around. I want to talk to you after the show's over and stuff like that. But everybody, thank you so much, each and every one of you guys, for tuning in, man. Much love. Many blessings to all of you. I know this is a really tough time with everything going on and everything's crazy. But, man, everybody just stay pious. You know, stay humble, stay safe, stay secure, stay positive. It'll all blow over. And as you know, we're talking about the Vedic stuff, Prabhupada, you know, who's a Hindu guru, smart guy, said that there would be a golden age within the Kali Yuga. And we are coming up on that golden age. I believe it. So many hails to everybody. Many blessings. And make sure you follow, like, subscribe, share over on the Dave Martell YouTube channel. And like, subscribe, share over on the Narota Society YouTube channel, where we will be from here on out. We're still going to do stuff here on the Dave Martell D-Live. Don't worry. Dave Martell D-Live's not getting thrown in the garbage. It's going to still be operating. We're going to do stuff. I'm going to play the Bog reruns. And then for those of you that missed this episode, you can check the replay down in the description, or you can go over to my YouTube and check it out over there, where you should like, subscribe, share, drop it into all your Telegram, drop it in your Discord, drop it on your Facebook, your Twitter, wherever. Give us a shout. Give us some promotion. Give us some promotion energy, guys. But anyways, I'll see you guys next time. Hail the gods. Hail the folk. Many blessings.